Welcome to Haunted History Chronicles, the podcast where we unravel the mysteries of the past, one ghostly tale at a time. I'm your host, Michelle, and I'm thrilled to be your guide on this eerie journey through the pages of history. Picture this, a realm where the supernatural intertwines with the annals of time, where the echoes of the past reverberate through haunted corridors and forgotten landscapes. That's the realm we invite you to explore with us. Each episode will unearth stories, long-buried secrets, dark folklore, tales of the macabre, and discuss parapsychology topics. From ancient legends to more recent enigmas, we're delving deep into locations and accounts all around the globe, with guests joining me along the way. But this podcast is also about building a community of curious minds like you. Join the podcast on social media, Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram, to share your own ghostly encounters, theories, and historical curiosities. Feel free to share with friends and family. The links are conveniently placed in the description for easy access. So whether you're a history buff with a taste for the supernatural, or a paranormal enthusiast with a thirst for knowledge, Haunted History Chronicles is your passport to the other side. Get ready for a ride through the corridors of time, where history and the supernatural converge, because every ghost has a story, and every story has a history. And now, let's introduce today's podcast, or guest. Today we're stepping into the shadowy world of Victorian mourning jewellery, an art form that not only adorned the living, but immortalised the departed. In the 19th century, mourning wasn't just a personal affair. It became an art form expressed through intricately crafted jewellery. Today we'll explore the poignant stories behind these hauntingly beautiful adornments, delving into a time when grief took on a tangible and wearable form. But we're not alone on this journey. Joining us is an extraordinary guest, a true connoisseur of the art of mourning, Hayden Peters, a jewellery historian, scholar and designer, is our guide into this fascinating realm. Hayden is the founder of The Art of Mourning, a platform established in 2005 to educate and share the rich history of mourning and sentimental jewellery. The Art of Mourning website at www.artofmourning.com serves as a beacon of knowledge, reaching thousands of international students and collectors daily. Hayden's dedication is evident in over 800 articles that meticulously detail the history of early modern society, politics, design and fashion, all through the lens of mourning jewellery. Hayden has made appearances on television, graced the pages of international publications, contributed to museum installations, and penned insightful pieces for academic publications. Today he brings his wealth of knowledge to the podcast. So prepare to be enchanted as we explore the delicate art of mourning through the eyes of Hayden Peters and begin to uncover the secrets woven into the threads of Victorian mourning jewellery. Hi Hayden, thank you so much for joining me today.
Hello Michelle, and thank you so much for your time today.
Do you want to start by just introducing yourself to the podcast listeners and sharing a little bit about yourself and your background?
Absolutely. So my name's Hayden Peters, and I run a platform called The Art of Mourning, which is dedicated to my lifetime's worth of research on mourning, sentimental jewellery, fashion and art. It's something which I began pretty much when I was in single digits, when I think back to it, because I was always fascinated with fashion from around the 18th century to the early 20th century. And what I did was I studied and I researched this fashion so much, specifically around men's fashion, but also women's fashion. And when I was very young, I started working. I began my own little business out the back of my parents' house, and it gave me enough money to put towards jewellery. And I was fascinated with Victorian silver and Victorian filigree jewellery. My father bought me one of my first pieces, which was a necklace. Essentially, it was a converted fob. So it was a Birmingham Shield from around 1896, beautiful silver piece. And I just fell in love with the design so much. And in my other career, I'm a very well-established designer. So this led into me going to a lot of antique fairs, a lot of antique shops, spending all my weekends. I didn't have that conventional childhood like most people do where, you know, you go out partying and you have other friends. All my friends were about 60-year-old antique dealers and fashion designers. So I was allowed to touch and feel and experience these jewels. It was probably the best education you could have because books can only tell you so much and museums are hidden behind glass. Here I could actually touch and feel these pieces. And I do recall around 1996, I believe, there was a ring that said "In Memory Of" in a black cartouche with the enamel work and two serpents coiled around the shoulders of this little ring. And in the back it said Mary Ann Lewis, and she died in 1853. I thought this was one of the most beautiful and one of the most sentimental things someone could ever do for somebody, because as much as I appreciated the Victorian silver for its design work, I thought this is the most beautiful way to encapsulate someone's life, to carry it forward, to think about them even when they're gone. And I think that's what makes memorial and sentimental jewellery the most pure kind of living history that you can collect today. It's still alive because it still has that part of somebody in it. And what I did was I started researching heavily into the life, the religion, the economics, the politics of a five-year bracket before and after 1853, so I could start to learn more about the context of why this ring was made. Why was it designed this way? Why did it say "In Memory Of"? What were the serpents? What did that even mean? And I had these friends who were jewelers, and I took it to them, and it had this little glass compartment in the back. And so they popped that out, and underneath was a coiled plait of Mary's hair. And I thought, oh, my gosh, that's even more sentimental. That's so beautiful. And ever since, I started collecting jewellery. And because of memorial jewellery being what it is, it's often signed and dedicated or it's hallmarked, so I can do the research before and after the five-year bracket. And my mission was to collect as many pieces from the earliest time of memorial jewellery's inception, which if you go back in the early modern period, it's around about the 1550s, or at least during, say, the reign of Henry VIII and the dissolution of the monasteries. And that's when you start to see the sentiment change about identity and fashion, especially, obviously, for the British. And it became a thing where I do have enough pieces to go back to 1550, and I go up to about 1920. Sometimes as late as 1940, but that's the collection I've got, and it's about 750 pieces. An Art of Mourning began in, I believe it was 2005. It's actually in my logo. And I was living in England at the time, and I have friends over in Gray's Antiques. There's Michelle Rowan and Charlotte Carrick over there, and they encouraged me to put all my knowledge down into writing. And so I developed Art of Mourning as a platform from there, and it's become very popular, and it's led me to do international lectures. I've even been the keynote speaker for the National Association of Jewelers in the UK. I've given lectures across America, Europe, Australia. I've been published on TV a few times on the radio, and yeah, it's become a bit of an obsession for me after the fact.
I can understand why, though, that it's something that people become very immersed in, because I think you touched on something that is very, very true, and that is that these are tangible pieces that you can hold. They are something very physical and a way of connecting with the past, but not just the past as some void, something unknown. These are connected with people. You can touch stories in the sense that you can often recognize names. You can see something very unique in the design and the symbolism that's been used as part of the jewelry. And I think that's what makes it something that really endures as a form of art and as something to collect and for people to be interested in, that this is something that just allows you to find that connection with someone and something from before us and their story and their way of memory, you know, remembering someone that meant so much to them and was very important to them in life and then in their death. And there's something really beautiful about that, I think, that is there in the story, but then also comes through in the artistry of the piece itself.
That's exactly right. There's so many different pathways you can take with A Morning Jewel. And this leads into people who are fascinated with genealogy all the way through to ephemera or even miniature portraits. So it's a gateway into so many different aspects of collecting. And that's what makes it so fascinating. I couldn't spend a lifetime doing one thing based on something so very simple, because if I look at a jewel, let's say I get a lot of people come up to me and ask about modern wedding rings. And sure, there's a lot of diamonds and there's some white gold there, but there's no dedication, there's no sentiment, and it is what it is. So it's very much a connection between two people, but to understand its context outside of its paradigm is very difficult, because it is so sentimental for them. Whereas these jewels resonate so much about their time. And if you do want to take that path down the genealogy route, I love it. It makes it so much more powerful as a storytelling piece. It adds to the value, the intrinsic value, of course. I won't speak to the cost value. And that's what's makes them so glorious. And that's why some people do just branch off into photography, because collecting photography does relate to these jewels.
Absolutely. And one of the things that I think you touched upon that I think is really important to stress is that for a lot of people, they think that mourning jewellery began during the Victorian period. You know, it's kind of become synonymous, hasn't it, with this this period of deep mourning because of Queen Victoria. But like you rightly said, mourning jewellery began much earlier. And I don't know if you want to elaborate a little bit more about when that began and how it evolved and why it became so popular during the Victorian period, to help listeners really understand that kind of evolution in terms of the history of the jewellery itself.
Oh, absolutely. To do this one correctly, I think I need to take you on a bit of a journey. Ever since the Protestant Reformation, it changed the perception of identity in the early modern period and the Renaissance period, really, going backtracking a little bit. And where the British were different than the rest of Europe is that England especially, they're locked within the sea, where you can actually have mercantilism with importing and exporting. Now, here you've got society which can rapidly industrialise during the 18th century, but also stay very insular with its thinking. There's lesser influence from external cultures, and this leads to almost a cult of identity, which Henry VIII was very much focused on, and that's where you've got limners and the rise of the miniaturists and miniature portraits, and using personal identity to change out the things which were previously used as, in an agrarian society, looking up towards a lord from the serf's perspective, working very hard in an agrarian culture to be judged under God. And the Catholics very much still maintained this idea of memento mori, which means remember you will die. And if you look through the chaplets and the rosary beads, which have this bead at the very end, which was often shaped like a skull, and the skull on the other side might turn into a face of the person, of a wealthy person in the Middle Ages. These jewels still maintained through the 16th century and onwards. But this was a way of saying your daily prayers, but also ending on the idea of death and you will be judged by God. Whereas during this new area of mercantilism, this new area of new wealth, which the English were doing, you've got a society which is rapidly changing, but also having enough money to spend towards other things like education, like focusing on rising wealth. By the 17th century, we have this new invention called retail, and we've got fashion. We've got money that people were putting towards other things which weren't just about that lifestyle. And so you've got people slowly starting to merge towards urbanization. And from that, you've got the memento mori for the English was turning into something which the wealthy men, these merchants, were wearing on their pinky fingers as a signet ring. So to give an understanding, because this isn't a visual medium, the memento mori designs are often distilled down to the skull and crossbones, the hourglass, the burning candle, the open Bible. And from this, from the Protestant Reformation, the Church of England was distilling down all of the symbols of life and death into their pure forms of what it should be under religion to live and die. Where, and this is to remove any Catholic symbols out of the church. At this point, by the late 16th century, there was a ban on any of the Catholic jewels, and that's where you've got to change out from, like, the rosary rings turned into decade rings. So you could still, there were still rings where you could say your prayers, but they were hidden under a different name. That's where you've got a ring with notches all the way around it. As you turn through the notch, you can say your prayers, but they were still banned. So we've got merchants with these skulls and crossbones, but by the turn of the 17th century, there was a little bit of a change out. We've got Charles I ascending towards the throne, and we've got, he's inherited high debt, he's married to a Catholic, and he has the divine right of kings. So following this, we have the Civil War, and the Puritans, led by Cromwell, felt that there wasn't enough done to remove Catholicism from the church. And so they were smashing windows where any forms of symbolism weren't aligning with very much those memento mori symbols. They wanted to remove as much as they could. Obviously, it's in the name, to be pure. So by 1649, it didn't go so well for poor old Charles I, and he was executed. And you've got your Cromwell's interregnum following this. But by the restoration of Charles II in 1660, that's where things changed. And that's where memento mori very much became part of the mourning jewels we understand today. Now, those designs that were made for the merchants who are wealthy to show that they could live a better life, to give that back to their children through education, to have a family, to show their wealth through fashion, was now being used as the fashion of death. And we have many, many forms of evidence during this time, from poems from John Donne talking about hair bracelets to the diaries of Samuel Pepys, where he's talking about 123 rings being given out at a funeral. These were elements of fashion. So a mourning ring would be fashioned with the skulls and crossbones and given out at a funeral. And they were kept and often given to the wife when a gentleman came back from a funeral, or but between the two of them shared, between friends and families. And this custom grew throughout 1680s to the 1690s, where you've got banking and you've got loans and you've got very much the Goldsmiths Guild taking over, and you've got people investing. This is where this new wealth really flourished, and the goldsmiths really flourished along at the same time. As an aside, I've done a lot of research into the goldsmiths and the jewelers of these times to show the different rings and things that they would make. The younger sort, there were even posy rings, which are known as poetry rings, where the younger gentlemen would go have a small band made of a ring for their sweetheart, and they would have a message written inside, usually in Latin or Middle French, and sometimes in very guttural English, because, you know, the dictionary wasn't developed yet until the 1760s. And so you've got to thee I choose, C-H-U-U-S-E, and beautiful little sentiments, and they were given to a loved one. But they carried on the form of mourning rings, because after someone passed away, let's say the gentleman husband at the time had passed away, the wife would have the ring stamped with a skull. And so the skulls and crossbones became synonymous with the idea of death. By the early 18th century, we have the Rococo period. This was the late Baroque period. And mourning rings from this point onwards, and jewellery in general, not just the rings, but bracelets and necklaces, brooches. They had these things called ribbon slides, which were very popular. They lasted from about 1680 to about 1730 in popularity. They were worn at the neck or the bodice. They're these little things that look like brooches, and they were worn on ribbons, beautiful little things. And here's where you've got the bezel in the interior was usually woven hair, and they would place the skull and crossbones motif on top, or say the putti or the cupid blowing trumpets with a skeleton, so you've got death sitting in between them. These were very, very typical for their times and worn by ladies. But by the early 18th century, they started to evolve, and that's where Rococo evolved the designs but kept the same interiors with the skulls and the crossbones and all those other memento mori symbols. But also you've got following this, so the Enlightenment's thoughts of life, liberty and property began to change things. You've got digs in Herculaneum and Pompeii around the 1711-1738 period. And you've got a lot of the British gentlemen going down throughout Europe and picking up lots of archaeology and lots of knowledge from the Mediterranean. They were bringing that back into England, and that's where we have the neoclassical period, which redefined mourning jewellery completely. And that's where the British and the Catholics really deviated. Whereas the Catholics still maintained the skulls and the crossbones, but anything else was very much a religious indoctrination, a depiction of Jesus, Mary, etc. Whereas the British used allegory, they were into storytelling, and they would appropriate an ancient Greek or an ancient Roman deity, or even just design that they'd found, and use that as a way of storytelling their grief. And in these jewels, there became these wonderful depictions of a lady weeping next to an urn or a tomb with a weeping willow over the top. And not only this, but especially during the 1780s, this became something of pop culture. We have so the Sorrows of Young Werther, a book by von Goethe, which was published, I think, around 1774. And there's a depiction of a lady in the book named Charlotte next to, and she's standing next to the tomb with an urn. And all the pretty young things at the time, they would go down to the cemeteries, they would stand there in the same sort of pose, holding the book, and even Napoleon had a copy of the book he'd carry around with him. And a lot of the jewellery designs with the urns, they were also pop culture. They weren't just for the sake of mourning. And that's where culturally we have to look into it a bit deeper. And many of the newspapers and primary sources of the time were talking about creating hair urns in the most popular taste. And so I've got many forms of primary evidence showing during the late 1770s, 1780s, these people, the goldsmiths, the hair artists, and the miniaturists, the silhouette artists, creating these different designs in many, many different ways for a society that was very hungry for them. And that's what led into, when we get to Victoria, a lot of her value system was based around these customs. It was very much the passing of Princess Charlotte in 1817. And when she passed away, there was a huge outpouring of grief because essentially she was being groomed to be the new Queen Elizabeth. This is George IV's daughter. And when she passed away in childbirth, there was an amazing outpouring of grief that created so many different mourning products. And at the time, you've got to think, well, this is balancing out the Napoleonic Wars, which were also focused on this high level of nationalism. All of these symbols and designs of the British were going into jewellery, whether it was a victory of a win through to the death of Nelson, were going into rings and jewels that were made. So nationalism, pride and mourning all came together. We even have Earl Marshall at the time decreed that the mourning custom had to change in its timeline because the general mourning period was shutting down shops of all sorts. Even the courts were shutting down, and economic stimulus is all part of what mourning jewellery and culture is all about. There were so many products produced, but the shops couldn't sell them. So they changed that timeline of when you could open up the stores just for this. And Victoria's sentimentality is all based around this, even her periods of mourning, which would effectively put a woman in mourning for about 2.5 years. And this, especially by 1861, when she transitioned into mourning, became the zeitgeist for all of the rest of the population to emulate her style. And you have to think that the monarch was always the doyen of fashion. They were the ones that people looked towards whenever they changed their fashion, whenever they invested in fashion. Even the Prince Regent, George IV, invested so much in fashion. You've got your Beau Brummels, you've got people who are, you know, being fashionable, you've got fashion gazettes. So Victoria, when she was married, her engagement ring was a serpent with emeralds for eyes, and people were reproducing the serpent as a design. And all these little designs that Victoria used, even her first birthday present from her father and her mother, was a heart-shaped locket with two locks of their hair woven together inside of it. people emulated that style. So as she changed and transitioned into this mourning period, people were stuck in, this is how it is. And that's where almost the stagnation of this led the next generation to branch out, to look towards France, to look towards the Americas and try and find other cultures which could change the designs of fashion, because she was so much set in her ways. And also this goes into economic stimulus, which all of the designs that she would use, the materials, were very much this balancing act of industrialization versus the cottage industries of the outer colonies. So what she would do is advertise, you have to use this certain kind of crepe for your morning dress, which was usually courtards. And I have stories about them too. They became, between 1835 and 1885, rose their capital from £40,000 to £450,000. They covered one third of the world in black crepe. They were selling it even in Australia. And when you've got a queen who says you can only use Parramatta wool for your morning dress, Parramatta is an area out of Sydney in New South Wales, the colony at the time, and this was exporting the wool that was produced there from the sheep. It's all about very careful economic stimulus, right down to the whippy jet industry, and that's what made these so very popular, because the Victorians were very commercially minded. You've got suburbs, and you've got a culture which never had seen the likes of leisure time before and travel. The rail networks were bringing people closer together to smaller cultures, which were producing mourning and sentimental jewels. We have so much variance by this time, but also we have so much standardization that if you were wearing a mourning outfit with a ring, or you were any type of mourning jewelry, and you were in America, Australia, India, Singapore, or even obviously Europe, you would be recognized and identified for your culture. And that's why these jewels have so many stories to tell, and why Victoria really was very much the queen of, you know, an empire where the sun never set. That's why these kinds of behaviors in mourning jewelry are very much part of our modern systems of behavior as well in Western culture. Even though we think they're gone, they're not really gone. And we understand the designs, because if you live in a society in America, in Australia, or any one of the colonies, you can look up and just see the architecture. I mean, I'm physically watching urns outside my window because I live in a Victorian building. All of that goes back into what I'm looking at, the same thing inside a ring. It's quite fascinating.
Hey there. Before we dive back into the podcast episode, I have a quick message for all you devoted listeners. If you've been enjoying the eerie stories and historical mysteries shared on any of the podcast episodes over the last few years, here's your chance to become an even bigger part of the ghostly community. You can now support the show by buying the podcast a virtual coffee. That's right. Just head over to ko-fi.com/Haunted History Chronicles and treat the podcast to a caffeine boost. Every little bit goes a long way in helping us uncover more haunted histories and share them with you. But wait, there's more. For those who want to dive deeper into the world of the paranormal, consider joining our Patreon family. Our Patreon page is a treasure trove of exclusive content, featuring hundreds of podcasts, both short and long articles, interviews, and other top secret materials you won't find anywhere else. And here's the exciting news. For February, all Patreon members, across all tiers, will receive bonus daily podcasts. It's like a paranormal advent calendar for the entire month. Now is the perfect time to join, support the show, and unlock a growing library of chilling encounters, reports, and in-depth research. Simply visit patreon.com/Haunted History Chronicles to become a patron today. But wait, I'm not quite done yet. If you're looking to show off your love for the Haunted History Chronicles in other ways, check out our brand new shop. We've got mugs, stickers, clothing, bags, and more, all featuring unique designs inspired by the podcast. So why not visit tpublic.com
and the Haunted History Chronicles shop page to snag your spooky swag. Whether it's buying us a coffee, joining me on Patreon, or rocking some Haunted History Chronicles gear, your support keeps the paranormal flames alive. Every small contribution helps me to continue to bring you more guests and deep dive content. All the links to the podcast Ko-fi page, Patreon, and the shop will be in the podcast description notes. You can also find them on our social media pages. So if you're ready to take your Haunted History Chronicles experience to the next level, head on over, show some love, and let's keep those ghostly tales alive. Now, back to the supernatural stories. You won't want to miss what's coming up next.
It's so intriguing, the influences and the trends that kind of feed into this, and the people, the individual people itself, but then also what's happening culturally, what's happening within that country, that period at the time, and how it all feeds into the fashion, the trends, the designs, and what, again, what endures, what lasts, and what we then still have today, because again, they're so enduring. And it really is so interesting when you start peeling back the layers to see the impact that this had on so many aspects in terms of trade. And it's incredible. It's really, really intricate and layered, and so interesting that the more you kind of look and the more you start to uncover some of this history, it's really fascinating.
I think what really interested me, especially with my last round of talks, which are the basis for a series of essays, which is becoming a book that I'm working on, I call it Profit and Loss. And it's those businesses, the retailers, department stores, and goldsmiths that profited from people's grief. And yeah. I find that really fascinating, because after working with the Goldsmiths Guild and, you know, listening to their stories and also going back into the research, I've got all of these very hardworking, not necessarily poor, but, you know, they're workers. And these goldsmiths, you would think, had so much capital because they can afford to produce beautiful pieces of gold with rich symbolism. But they're all under the commission of whoever went to the retailer to commission it, and then they get the capital to produce. So we have some designers of these rings, especially in the 19th century, where, yeah, they're very similar in style, but the gold varies wildly from very low-grade alloys to 22-carat gold, and some for very influential people and some for very middle-class people. And yet the people who created them really were just the conduit. They were just living between commissions. And I find that so fascinating, as opposed to the big design houses, which created some beautiful stuff. Even Tiffany has a mourning brooch that they produced. But it's the workers who I find the ones that didn't really get a chance to express themselves more than just whatever someone wanted.
Absolutely. And I find it fascinating that this was also something that enabled women to have a profession as well, because they were often involved in the weaving of the hair and things, weren't they, in their kind of their living rooms and their spaces in their homes, which, yeah, I think it just kind of shows how it impacted all levels of society too.
It's not, I love that, especially the women's story. Women were the ones who not only create the style in the very inception, but also because they had to wear it. So they're the ones who, even the French with the hair artistry in their advertising for a chap named Limner in the 1850s, they would call the British walking tombstones because of their designs were so austere and so, you know, proper and in memory of, whereas the French were used hair designs for flowers and things. But the women were the ones to end the entire understanding of the periods of mourning, because they couldn't afford to, and there was not enough money left behind in wills to produce the different products that they were required to wear in mourning. So if their house wasn't designed in a way where you're covered in black crepe, all the mirrored surfaces are covered, you're dressed in a certain way for 2.5 years, which, you know, had slight variances, but every time there was a variance, that costed money. So after 1 year and 1 day in crepe, you went for 9 months with less crepe, and then you went for 3 months into black silk. That's the first stage, the second stage, and the ordinary stage. That costs a lot of money. And the women, especially during the 1870s, were very vocal against it. And a lot of the pomp of Because we associate, especially the Victorian era, which is a very long time, with all mourning, but it wasn't. It was really between about 1861 and around 1875. That's when it really peaked. And then it went downhill from there, because a funeral was costing up to about £600 in their money for a proper funeral. People couldn't afford that. And you had a lot of businesses that were capitalizing off that, especially the burial societies, which were a form of friendly society, which in turn became our modern, you know, insurance companies that we were giving all this money to, these poor things. And a lot of these people didn't have enough money to really survive, yet they had to have a good funeral. And that's what the products, the jewelry and all of that cascaded from. It changed so much. But it also supported a lot of people. We have, there's one lady who was a silhouette artist, and she was a traveling silhouette artist in the late 18th century. And she was very, very well known. She was a woman of status and married to a gentleman. And she was quite an influential artist, doing not only just memorial, but sentimental silhouettes, because they're not memorial, there's very small subset of them are. But yeah, the women could work, hair artistry, absolutely. And if you go over to other cultures, America is very different in so many ways with their society, how they've grown in terms of their scope across a very wide country, but they kept the same basic elements as when the Puritans came over. The hair artistry was taught down from mother to daughter, right down. It's basically a form of needlework. You find these things called samplers, which woven pieces which might depict a certain time or a message about a family, and some of those were woven from human hair.
It's fascinating, and like I said, I think the fact that you can see something in fashion of clothes and fashion of jewellery, the fact that it's something that was there in every level of society. So you really can see how it was used, the styles, all of it. You can learn so much in terms of the social history, the economic history. All of it is absolutely fascinating. I think something that you touched upon is also really important to note, which is that mourning jewellery, again, I think people tend to think of it as something only being worn by women. But mourning jewellery was something that men and women would wear, and you would see it come through in things like cufflinks. Yep. So it's something that, again, transcended gender as well as class systems, which, again, I'm not sure that people really necessarily are aware of, simply because of the sheer volume of pieces that women, I think, could wear in comparison to men. It was something that everybody would have to kind of follow that etiquette, wouldn't they, of the rules of mourning.
You know, it's funny you mention that, because I'm actually looking at a piece from 1792 right now, and it shows a gentleman leaning against the tomb with an urn on top in beautiful watercolour. It's a gorgeous piece. And that's actually more of a portrait of that gentleman. So whenever there's a literal depiction in those allegorical ones I mentioned, that's actually them, that's that person. And yeah, absolutely. Not only that, but in the Victorian times, one of the most common accessories, which I think is one of the most accessible ways to enter this realm of collecting memorial and sentimental, hair chains and the watch chains that gentlemen would wear, very commonly were made from human hair. You could purchase them from just about any catalogue on the planet. They were widely advertised. Hair artists were everywhere, from Pitt Street, Sydney, in the colony of New South Wales, right the way through to, there were seven in a small cluster right in the centre of London. They were everywhere. And I've got New York, Philadelphia, you name it. These pieces, there was a huge competition between hair artists, by the way. They would advertise aggressively against each other during the 19th century. And they would advertise that, you know, 1 ounce of hair could produce an entire chain of a necklace, 1 ounce. But often what they would do is they would color match their hair. They would buy it from other cultures, which, you know, the nunneries would generally grow their hair out very long, the nuns, and then we cut that and sell that into other cultures. It became very, very, I believe it rose, I'd have to go back to my research, but it's around 50 francs to about 500 francs per pound to import hair into France during the 1850s. So it rose the price of hair dramatically, and they would give the hair back, the little cut of hair, and you know, that's what the hair artist did. But are these mourning pieces? Well, that's the thing about hair work. No, it's very, once again, a very smaller subset of these pieces were made for mourning. They're just common sentimental goods that the Victorians would wear. But you will find that there are many, many chains with the thing about chains is, from the catalogues where you could purchase them, the charms were often bespoke. So whether it was a monogram, an in memory of sentiment, an acorn, whatever that little charm was, you might find a one with the black enamel and a mourning sentiment on it. So they're not very expensive. They're quite beautiful and very, very functional, and gentlemen's pieces too. And often these were handed down to the children. But most of the time, especially with the rings, the ones that were given out at funerals, they were kept by the family. That's why they're in such good condition today. They weren't necessarily worn. They were bought out for special occasions. They're not really functional pieces that were meant to last a lifetime, even though that's what their representation is meant to do. I've got one actual interesting tale. Is there was a very wealthy shipping magnate in England, and he passed away in about 1901. And he left behind for his very close friends and colleagues about £100 for a mourning ring, and then for his staff and the workers, £1 per ring. So it's very much this thing that propagated so wide, but well, they were all men. That wasn't for the wife. That was just a little symbol of him to give to remember him by.
Which is brilliant, isn't it? And I think the fact that we have these, this history, I think, again, just tells us so much, doesn't it, about the importance of this and the status with which, like you've kind of rightly pointed out, that this was also a way of imparting your status, you know, by being able to do this, a sign of your wealth and your position and so on. And that importance of being remembered, that this was supposed to be something that would last, in the same way that they were also obviously putting so much thought into other ways of remembering them in kind of the funerary art, the symbolism on tombs and on memorials and so on and so forth. You see it all kind of there, kind of coming through in all of these different areas, the importance and the significance of it.
Oh yes, absolutely. And once again, with status and design, this is an interesting one, especially for the 19th century. There was such rapid change with the different styles that were permeating different cultures. In the 1870s, we have a huge classical revival. It's technically around the 1867 Paris exhibition, where you've got some of the major jewelers around the world showing off a lot of the archaeological jewels that were emulating the styles of the Greeks and the Romans. The Victorians were very cyclical like that. They would copy and reappropriate, not dissimilar, I suppose. We do that today. But the way that you would show status is in the symbolism of the design in the jewel. So you do find pieces with cameos, intaglios, with symbols of classicism. But if you look under the skin of it, they're actually mourning jewels as well, even though, once again, a smaller subset. But you do find that they emulated their style and time, because the lady, generally the lady who would wear them, would need to be fashionable and show that status. You know, one of the ones that interests me the most, being Australian, I'm from the state of Victoria in Australia, is the gold rush, which happened in 1851. And Melbourne became the most wealthy city in the world at the time, because we were pretty much the gold source for the British Empire. And a lot of the very, very poor and desperate younger men around the planet, from America, Poland, England, everywhere, Scotland, you name it, they were coming here. And in 1851 to 1852, the population jumped by 74,000 people just in Melbourne, and they were moving off to the gold fields to pioneer as much as they could. There was alluvial gold that you could just pull out of the ground. And the designs that were happening influenced many of the jewels that the men who succeeded would take back over to Europe. And a lot of the Australian flora and fauna were used in memorial and sentimental jewels. So you see these wonderful depictions of our natural animals and plants taken back to Europe as this cultural fascination, but they also have woven hair in the back. It's one of those small little times where cultural fascination breeds status. Another one would be the Halley's Comet in, I think it was around 1836, and Halley's Comet brooches, which are still produced today with this sort of larger round area in the front to emulate the comet. And then you've got a tail with another little gem in the back, usually to emulate the spray. And this was the tail of the comet. And many of these were also, I've got one that says in memory of, and it's just this wonderful little cultural fascination of its time. But it's something which, if you don't look through the right lens, you wouldn't know necessarily what it is. It just looks like another brooch. And that's where design, beyond the in memory of the black enamel, the buckle and the garter design, which is so very typical. The burning torch for the Victorians was another one that was very popular. In memoriam and the variations of those, which originated back in the early 19th century from biblical quotes, that became, because religion is a huge part of standardization for mourning jewels. The Gothic revival is a whole area I could talk about and why that was popular for design of for the Victorians. But that standardization creates piety, creates a very focused society, which has proprietary and also the right Christian family and how you should behave. But when you get the ones that are just a little bit different and they just don't really look right, or they're just a bit strange, that's where the stories really tumble out. And I find those wonderful.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of misconception, and I think people have a perceived notion as to what the mourning jewellery looks like in terms of whether it's simply just got to have the hair work or certain types of material, colour. You know, I think people have misconceptions because they're the ones maybe that are popular in terms of get viewed, get shown, get talked about. But like you've mentioned, there are so many different types of subsets and slight changes and alterations. And again, it kind of makes the artistry of the pieces that much more fascinating and interesting, and this the layers and stories behind them. But then also, like you pointed out, just this very rich symbolism and how that could be influenced by other cultures, travel, all of these other things that made its way into mourning jewellery, which again is just so fascinating. The symbolism and how it was deployed and used as part of that artistry is just, it's a whole other topic. I think there's so many aspects and tangents to that. It's just so intriguing how that has been used to represent different things in this type of jewellery.
Oh, absolutely. I'd love to talk to you about it someday. I could go on that tangent. I'd love to go on that Gothic revival tangent. It's so interesting because it relates so much to even the French Revolution. It goes that far back and then develops from there. It's very interesting.
Yeah, absolutely. So one of the things that I think would be interesting to ask you whether you know is as to whether or not, you know, these pieces, were they different from who it was tendered for? So, for example, if it was a style of mourning for a spouse versus a piece for a parent or a sibling, were there any differences or something that you would expect to kind of come through in some of those types of jewellery pieces that might represent a mourning for a specific type of loved one?
Those types of pieces usually correlate with the late 18th century, early 19th century, so pre-Victoria. By Victoria's time, everything was so industrialized and catalogued that the bigger designers were producing the ones which were copied all around the planet. So something which was setting a template for in memory of in London was very much going to be reproduced over in New York. Those earlier ones, though, that's where you get the really interesting stuff. So you might find something which has... I found one the other day which has a philosopher's bust on top of a plinth being adorned with a garland. And, you know, you've got something which, for the philosopher, it's something which that person identified with as that philosopher. And that's a child showing that back to a parent. That's saying that this is how my father wanted to be represented, as an intelligent person. You might have another one. There's a beautiful one in the V&A Museum, which has nipped in the bud, and it's got a flower and it's got another flower next to it with it being cut off and falling to the ground. And that's actually from the child, from the dedication of a father to the friend. So at the time, the friend was still alive, and then the friend passed away, so it became a double mourning ring. And you find these sorts of ones interesting because those symbols start to differ. The ones where you've got So the allegorical symbols in general were pre-designed. So many of the traveling miniaturists, they were pre-designing on usually ivory discs, the design of the urn, the plinth, the weeping willow, and they would customize the name for the person on top of that with usually an ink or even cut hair or both. They would desiccate the hair and put that into the ink and then paint. Those ones are very standard, but when you get to the more higher society pieces, that's where you get the really interesting stuff. In the 19th century, you'll find more of the dedications start to change. So I've got one piece which has five different family members in it. It's a very typical starburst design in blue enamel. The enamel work, that's probably where the Victorians did use design to change a little bit. They were focused on, let's say, blue enamel. That would be to represent royalty through the colour of royal blue. There was, you know, red for passion, that sort of thing. So you do find the occasional ones which have different enamel work, but it's the dedication inside and underneath. That's where you find, almost like a tombstone, that more personalised inscription of what the epitaph would be for the father or the mother or even the child. It's very typical. Oh, and children in general, that's probably another fascinating one where you see more variance. So in the 18th century pieces, you'll find, I just looked at one yesterday, actually. I wrote an article about it. There's a butterfly flying from the chrysalis, and there's so much storytelling there, which goes into Greek history, but it also shows the soul leaving the body, going into the heavens, this rebirth. And for children, white enamel is the most popular colour to be used because that shows innocence, purity, and virginity. Whenever you see a white enamel piece, that's exactly what it means. It can be for an unmarried lady or obviously a child or both. And the symbolism you might see there could be the bird leaving a cage, flying off into the heavens. And if a woman in those days, in the 18th century, was holding the cage with the cage closed and the bird inside, she's holding her virtue. Often if she's giving it to a man, that's an offering of marriage and offering her virtue. And if the bird's flying away, usually it's the bird flying off into the heavens and someone's passed. And if you've got that with the white enamel, then you've got something pretty interesting. So yeah, there's some variations, which you don't often see, but they're there.
Again, just fascinating, because what you've got is story being told through colour and through symbolism that, like you said, just has its own story in itself, but again reveals so much in terms of what they're trying to say about the person behind that story, their virtue, their purity, their kind of innocence, all of these other things that, again, so much nuance there, I think, that is just really interesting.
Some of my favourites, actually, I forgot to mention. Because the British and all of the sort of diaspora of the British and, you know, the Church of England and the societies and cultures that they re-established or set up had their own design. The Europeans, so Northern German, mostly around the North European area, still with Protestant cultures, they used the designs of the neoclassicism but started to look through them with their own lens. Very interesting pieces. I've lived in Berlin and seen many of them there. Those ones, they use allegory, but not in the same way. Because there's still that Catholic influence, they're very reticent to show that weeping lady. And that lady is often the ideal depiction of our grief if she's weeping next to the tomb. So that takes away from the religious aspect of what we should be doing, which is worshipping God in the Christian faith. Not to say they weren't Christian, of course they are, but it's still not Catholic. So what they did was they depicted romantic depictions of the castle in bucolic scenarios. You might see a churchyard with a gravesite in front of it with a little the crucifix in the graveyard, or two people crossing a river in a boat. And those things give you the option of considering it through your own lens of perception, or is it just beautiful? And that's actually a very hard for an historian to look back on, to try and distill that into what it really meant. But after a few different depictions, you start to get the impression of what they were and what their culture was. But they're fascinating because they're very different. They use all the same design elements of painted on ivory, the sepia tones, often sometimes with the cut up hair and use that in the same scenario, but very, very different from what the English were doing.
Gosh, that's intriguing. There's so much art to this, isn't there? There's so much thought in every part of it, the detail, that again, I just think helps to really contribute to that process of memorialising a loved one that has made it so enduring, so that all this time later, it's still something of huge significance, because you can look at a piece from so many different aspects, through so many different lenses, and uncover something different with a different, you know, kind of look at it. And that's, I think, the really intriguing part of looking at the fashion of what you're looking at, the symbolism of what you're looking at, all of the things that we've been discussing. I mean, it's just incredible, really, when you start to really examine these tiny little pieces, but what they tell us.
I know, it's so wonderful to look at. And once you start, it took me about 15 years to create my narrative and put together my thesis, because it was so tying those little elements of history together through the primary research and how people interacted and through diaries, through everything else. And you start to see the design and the culture and how you start to have that aha moment of, oh, that's why that happened. Recently, when I was doing research into photography and also the development of the printing press, one of the great reasons why a lot of these symbols still exist today, and they're reflected obviously in funerary art, in cemeteries, tombstones, because a lot of those symbols that were used in classicism, the Victorians were using in mourning cards and funerary cards, are these funeral cards, which Victoria was not a fan of in the 1870s. She actually frowned upon them and said they were a French tradition. But, you know, once again, economic stimulus, the use of photography and printing. The British, all the colonies, made such a big business out of them. And they took over from the custom of the jewellery almost seamlessly. So by the 20th century, the mourning cards became so popular to send internationally because we have post. Because I could say that my loved one lives in a different country, yet within a few days they're going to be notified about my cousin's passing. So there it is. And those designs still exist today. The interpretation is still there, because if you love art history, it's not gone. And obviously I've dedicated so much writing and everything through my website and everything else to learning more about it and to helping people educate about it. But you just have to look and see it. And I think that's where, if you walk through a cemetery, you sit down, discover what those symbols mean, beyond of it being a set template, which was popular in the 1930s or the 20s or the 1890s. You start to see the rich storytelling that goes into it. And the other thing is, that's not necessarily what that person's feeling or the family's mood was. That's just what they were sold. And there's that balancing act between commerce and emotion, and we've got to always go for commerce, unfortunately.
Do you have any particular mourning jewellery pieces or styles or collections that stand out for you personally, either for their historical significance or the, I don't know, the emotional resonance or the craftsmanship? Do you have any favourite pieces?
I think for craftsmanship, I'm always going to fall back on anything made between about 1780 and 1830, where not only was there such huge social change, there were so many different variances of trying to understand the style and standardize it and get it right. So a lot of what we were talking about with personal symbolism, the paintings on ivory, the depictions of a person or a lady pointing upwards towards the heavens, holding an anchor for faith, hope, and charity, how that relates to society, and especially in the early 19th century, British pride in the Navy was changing a lot of mourning jewellery to become using lots of naval influences, because that's where their might was. Those things I find very fascinating. That's where you've got things like the eye miniatures, so eye portraits, which were very much a niche at the time. So George IV and the Prince of Wales married Maria Fitzherbert, so a Catholic widow, and that was annulled by his dad. So what he did was he had a portrait made up of her eye, and he wore that, so they say, under his lapel until he died. And that was one of those little things which was supposed to be hidden. It was supposed to be anonymous, that even though he it was very widely known that he was in love with her, this satire all through the newspapers. It's one of those things which was supposed to be secret, yet the pretty young things, they all emulated and copied that style. So you've got ones for sentimentality and you've got ones for mourning. And there's some beautiful ones with like a teardrop shape in black enamel with the eye set in them. They're very rare. There's people copying them these days, but there weren't a great deal of them produced because they were such a niche. And in this period, a small thing that I love the weird things. You've got the rise of this style called canateel work, where you've got, say, hammered gold and you've got gold wire work, which was used to make the jewel look bigger, essentially. And this is because of the wars, Napoleonic Wars. The gold is going to the war effort, and the goldsmiths, they're in high demand. There are people going off to war, and these people wanted to give tokens of love to their sweethearts, or if they'd passed on, they needed to have a jewel. So they're producing jewelry at a rapid rate, but they're in lower grade alloys. They're in as much gold as they could use. And so there was no standardization of the designs of these pieces. So they look big, but they're actually not incredibly well produced. And also that's where hair became very popular. Hair was always popular and used, but in the voluminous nature of how it was used, the taking over of a gem, where gems at that time were still very popular. The price had fallen off the cliff after the French Terror because many, many homes were raided. The gold was taken, pieces were broken up, the gems were just scattered throughout Europe, the prices dropped, but paste became very popular. So foil glass in the color. So you've got acrostic jewelry, D-E-A-R-E-S-T, diamond, emerald, amethyst, ruby, sapphire, topaz, or E-S-T, emerald, topaz, sorry. They spell out that from the first letter of the gem spells out the message of love. And those ones I think are great. And that's where the meaning of color came from. But those pieces, once again, were just sentimental for their time. And I think that's one of the biggest heights of like pure sentimentality in those cultures at that time. Whereas as you get towards more of the industrialization of society, things were very much standardized. And yes, because of the nature of these jewels, they are still sentimental and loved, and they have such a rich message. But also they were made in such high volume in the, you know, hundreds per funeral, which at a very low cost, you could get some as low as 30 shillings for a ring back in those days by the 1850s. They were just cheap enough to be produced. We have the 1854 Hallmarking Act, where we've got lower grade alloys. So you can go down to about 14 carat, I think it was. And that's where mass production really took off. And so those early pieces, especially the ones where you've got that really different symbolism, I've seen ones with all sorts. I've seen ones with astrology in them, painted on ivory. And it does make you sit down and think, you know, what on earth were they thinking? What does that even mean for that person? And I love that. So for me, it's those pieces. But I think, you can't forget your first, and that's with In Memory Of written on the top. I do think that's the most pure sentiment of all. So yeah, my first ring for Marianne Lewis, that's what's always going to win it for me.
I think there's just something beautiful in all of it. And I think it's almost like music. It's like when you can appreciate art, you can find something beautiful and magical in all of them that really resonate for different reasons. And I think that's what's really enduring about when you look at this, it's what they all reveal. They're all so unique. And yeah, it's been so unbelievably fascinating to talk to you. I think we could talk about jewellery forever and symbolism and this kind of go down this route and this path. There's just so many parts to it. It's incredible the more you look into it. And yeah, I just appreciate you giving up some of your time this evening to talk about a little part of this with us and for people listening.
Michelle, it's an absolute pleasure. Thank you so much for your time and allowing me to even talk about these. If anything I can do is a thrill just to educate and offer as much for a new society and a generation to learn about them, because if we never forget them, they're never gone. So these jewels will last forever and the message of love will last forever. And we're just caretakers for their knowledge and what they are. And if we carry them forward, then what more could be said? That's so beautiful.
And I think that's the perfect sentiment, absolutely sums it up completely. And I echo that. And I will make sure that all of your details for your website, your Patreon page, your social media pages, etc., go onto the podcast description notes and on the website so that people can find you easily, come and see what you're about, see some of the articles, find out more if they want to, because I think, yeah, there's so much more to this. If it interests you and you want to take that deep dive, there's material there, and you've done an awful lot of work to help bring that together for people, to help raise that awareness and educate them about some of this. So yeah, I will make sure to put that all together and make that easy to signpost people to you.
Oh, bless you, and thank you so much.
And I will say goodbye to everybody listening. Bye, everybody.